With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Is there a better time to enjoy a fresh-cooked meal than spring? So many ingredients are at the peak of their growing seasons, and flavors in full bloom at HelloFresh. Enjoy the taste of spring with chef-crafted recipes featuring ripe seasonal ingredients delivered right to your door. And there's no more scouring the grocery store for that one ingredient you need to complete your recipe, something I know a whole lot about. HelloFresh takes away all that hassle by delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients so you have exactly what you need, and it helps you cut down on food waste. And HelloFresh cares about quality. That's why their seasonal ingredients are picked at peak ripeness and travel from farm to your home in less than 7 days, so you know that they're fresh. As I've told you on the podcast before, I am not a great cook. My wife, my oldest daughter, they can stare into the fridge, see a couple of ingredients, add some spices, and boom, we have a great meal. Me, I need a plan. HelloFresh gives me that plan. They make it easy, that's so easy that I can cook a great dinner. So if you want to join HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. That's code 1616BA2023 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. And remember, HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. You can join the club today. Get HelloFresh.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague, Peter Flaherty. Millie is off this week because she's not in Omaha. That's where Peter and I have been for the last week plus now. And we are rolling into the finals at this point. We record this on Friday morning after one of the best games of the College World Series, possibly ever. Neither Peter or I is really old enough to put a definitive take on that. Peter, I think, frankly, if you added the two of our ages, in fact, I know if you added the two of our ages, we still don't get to how old the College World Series is. So, you know, sometimes we just have to like take a step back and acknowledge like, well, there was a lot of history here. And, you know, like we are not the best people to say definitively whether that was the best or not. What I can say is that was an unbelievable baseball game between LSU and Wake Forest last night. And the result was LSU, as I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast knows, LSU won, advances to the College World Series Finals, where they will play Florida. So that's what we're going to talk about today, a little bit about previewing that final series, a little bit about how we got to that final series. But it's been a fantastic week of baseball here at the College World Series.
Yeah, it's been an outstanding one. Obviously, not culminating with last night because we've still got a what figures to be a really good championship series on tap, but it's been a week filled with close games, competitive games, exciting moments. And coming into the College World Series, there was a lot of buzz around the amount of talent on the field that all eight teams has, and it's more than lived up to it with each team getting performances out of their dudes, so to speak. And last night, as you mentioned, I neither nor Teddy can speak upon games dating too far back, but at least in my lifetime and certainly in my rookie year of doing this, I'm going to be hard pressed to find a better game than what transpired last night. I'm having a absolute brain fart. We reached up very late last night, but not only for like how the game shaked out with the 2-0 11 inning result, but also the amount of talent in either dugout with Dylan Cruz and Paul Skeens, most notably for LSU, and then for Wake Forest, obviously Rhett Lauder and Brock Wilkin, but you can go up and down the roster. So a great College World Series, and it figures to end here in the next couple of days with hopefully another couple of really good games.
Yeah, to this point in the World Series, there have been just two games that have had a run margin of more than three runs. There was 6-1 TCU over Oral Roberts, but even in that game, Oral Roberts loaded the bases in the ninth inning. They didn't quite get the tying run to the plate, obviously, but that ninth inning was a little tense for TCU fans. I'm sure for Oral Roberts fans as well. But things got tense for TCU at the end there. And then there was also LSU 5-0 over Tennessee. And that was a good game and like a tight game. Tennessee did not load the bases in the ninth inning. So it wasn't quite as dramatic, but every other game has been 1, 2, or 3 runs. And, last night, Thursday night, LSU goes into the 11th scoreless with Wake Forest, and Tommy White hits a walk-off 2-run homer. And according to ESPN Stats and Info, that was the first time in College World Series history, which, again, dates back like 76 years at this point, that a 0-0 tie was broken by a walk-off home run. So it was historic. It was just a great game all the way around. You know, Peter mentioned the talent in both dugouts. The pitching matchup was everything anyone would have wanted out of Skeens and Lauder, which was arguably on its own just the best matchup, you know, in terms of like All-American status and draft status that the College World Series had ever seen. Certainly the best that it had seen in like, I don't know, like 30. Well, I guess I should say that 2 years ago, Will Bednar and Kamar Rocker did face off. Those were both top 15 picks. And Bednar's All-America status was a little wonky because what he did during the NCAA tournament really pushed it over the top. So depending on when your favorite outlet did All-American teams, like kind of was like, well, is Bednar an All-American or not? I'm pretty sure by Baseball America standards he was, but like maybe we could have pushed him up even further if we had waited until after the entire tournament. Anyway, the point is that two top 15 picks matched up in Rocker and Bednar a couple years ago. But otherwise, I mean, that kind of matchup is exceedingly rare. Lauder and Skeens super lived up to the hype. Skeens goes 8 scoreless. Lauder goes 7 scoreless. They both happened to set their program single season strikeout record in the same game. It was just an incredible night on the mound, no matter who you're talking about. Like the relievers that were brought in for both teams, both pitched well, both have, you know, both teams have a really strong bullpens, and you know, it's not just that they pitched well, they have a fair amount of like stuff and prospectiness to them. So it was that game is not going to be forgotten in Omaha history or in LSU history or even in Wake Forest history. Like they might not want to reflect on it quite as much, but give it a few years and I think they're going to, you know, look back very, you know, they will be willing to look back and say like, that was a really good game. And Rhett Lauder pitched incredibly well on that stage. And so yeah, just an incredible night of baseball here in Omaha on Thursday night.
Yeah. And after, so Wake was 2-0 to start bracket 2 play. LSU was on the ropes as they were just 1-1 and needing to beat Wake twice to advance to the College World Series final. They did so first on Wednesday night with a 5-2 win over the Deacs. And then after that, it was kind of, there was this buzz of, oh, you know, we might get Lauder Skeens. And it wasn't confirmed until about two and a half hours before first pitch, maybe even a little sooner than that. And again, it was probably the most hyped pitching matchup in recent memory, just because of both the prospect status, the stuff that they have. I mean, this is, you're talking about arguably the two best arms in college baseball going head to head in Omaha with a trip to the College World Series finals on the line. And then pitching matchup aside, you've got two great lineups with LSU and Wake Forest. It had all of the hype and possibility to be one of the games of our lifetimes, and to see it live up to it and play out how it did was, I was so lucky to be able to be there in attendance for it and watch it. And as you mentioned, Skeens and Lauder were each excellent. Skeens went 8 shutout innings on short rest, mind you, in which he allowed just 2 hits, struck out 9, walked 1. The fastball was up to 101. And as he, for the entirety of his outing, he pitched, I think, in the 95 to 98, 99 mile an hour range. And then the slider, as it has all year, flash double plus in my mind, got a ton of swing and miss. And then with Lauder, same kind of deal. 7 shutout, only 3 hits, struck out 6. His trademark changeup was hellacious on both left and right-handed hitters. Commanded all of his offerings really well, and they each did a fantastic job of navigating a really, really, really strong opposing lineup. And for Wake, Nick Kurtz was a late scratch. I'm not sure if there was an official word on it, but the
word from the broadcast, and I guess Tom Walter did repeat this in the post game as well, but it was ribs. Yeah, that he got hit in the ribs now almost 2 weeks ago in Super Regionals against Alabama, and then there was some sort of aggravation of that injury during the pregame warmups.
Yeah, so that was definitely a bummer for Wake. I know Kurtz had been struggling to this point. I think he was just 0 for 9, but man, taking a bat like that out of your lineup is it's really tough. And I was down on the field for BP, took BP fine, took ground balls fine, so it must have been something in further getting loose, or it might have been a swing where he felt a twinge. But bottom line, that stinks. But luckily the Deeks get him back next year as he's still an underclassman. But as for the game itself, again, you mentioned it, more than lived up to the hype. Both the starters were great, and then also with the relievers, Thatcher Hurd fired 3 shutout innings after throwing 3 innings of one-run ball in the Deeks and Tigers' first meeting. Michael Massey came out of the bullpen, got out of some trouble, blew a mid-90s fastball by Dylan Cruz, struck out 5 in his 2 2/3 innings before giving way to Camden Manassi, whose outing was very short-lived, as on the first pitch, Tommy White took a hanging slider out to left field for a walk-off blast. So a game for the ages in all aspects. And I think when looking at the finals of LSU and Florida, obviously you have 2 outstanding clubs, but I think that with Florida being able to line up its pitching, LSU they're emerging from this all-out brawl and prize fight, a little bit battered and bruised. 3 games with Wake Forest will do that to you. So it'll be, I think, a little bit of an uphill battle on the mound for the Tigers as we get into this weekend.
We'll just have to see how that all shakes out in terms of LSU's pitching. We'll get into the specifics of this matchup here in a second, but when you're coming out of this having used Skeens twice to get here, obviously you're not in as optimal a position as Florida, which swept through their bracket. The Gators have won 3 one-run games here in Omaha. They opened the thing with a 6-5 win against Virginia. And that game was it was a week ago now, but it was a really good game. Virginia was up late. Florida needed a comeback. They get it in the 9th, and they they go on to win 6-5 there. Then they beat Oral Roberts 5-4. Again, just a really tight game. And then Florida takes down TCU 3-2 in also an insane game. In that one, TCU ties the game late against Florida closer Brandon Neely. Florida gets a run in the top of the 9th on they kind of manufacture a run basically, and Michael Robertson came on as a pinch runner and scored the go-ahead run. And then in the bottom of the 9th inning, Braden Taylor sends a missile to center field, and Michael Robertson, who again just entered the game as a pinch runner in the top of the 9th inning, tracks down the ball at the wall and makes a catch. In a lot of other ballparks, that ball's out. The wind was blowing in Omaha, however, so it stayed in the ballpark. I mean, it still very easily could have been a double, but Robertson was able to track it down and hold on to the ball as he crashed into the wall for a game-ending catch against a dude that's going to be picked in the top 15 picks. It was incredible. It wasn't quite what happened last night with LSU and Wake Forest, but that TCU game for Florida in the finals was a spectacular game that was very tight the whole way through and then ends on one of the best defensive plays of the tournament. It might have been the defensive play of the tournament at the time. There was a potentially better one last night in that LSU game as Trey Morgan makes a great play on a squeeze play. But that Michael Robertson catch was a sensational ending to that one.
Yeah, an unbelievable catch. And off the bat with Braden Taylor, I thought it had a chance to leave. I know it was hit to the deepest part of the ballpark, but it absolutely jumped off the bat. Just the sound it made and the flight, I was like, oh man, this has a chance. Then I watched Michael Robertson track it down and crash into the wall to complete the catch and send Florida to the finals. It's up there for defensive play of the tournament. I think it's right behind Trey Morgan's safety squeeze play right now, but it's a firm number two. And as Michael Robertson said, he was going to run through the wall if he had to make a catch, and it was evident with how he tracked it down. He went full speed into the padded wall out there in right center. And I think that the theme for Florida has just been finding a way. They haven't really had a shellacking or dominant performance in any of their three wins. With Virginia, they trailed 5-3 in the ninth before a pair of solo home runs and a Luke Heyman sack fly. One of the home runs, Wyatt Langford's, was the farthest ball hit in Charles Schwab Stadium history, with traveling 456 feet in early tournament. That game feels like it was like 4 years ago now, but
yes.
it was a great early moment in the College World Series. And then with Oral Roberts, that I think now is known as the Coach O'Sullivan mound visit game, in which they lost track account of how many mound visits they were allotted. He went out to talk to star closer Brandon Neely in the eighth inning, it was, but that was the mound visit in which he was forced to make a pitching change. So he had to turn to freshman Cade Fisher unexpectedly. Oral Roberts made it extremely interesting with a Matt Hogan inside the park home run. And then in the ninth inning, they also had runners on first and third with two outs before Cade Fisher got a Jacob Godman fly out to end the game. So for Florida, it's just been, honestly, they've found a different way to win in each of the three games, which I know that what they've done hasn't been the most impressive, but I find that extremely impressive in and of itself, with just no matter the hand that they're dealt or the circumstances that they face, they time and time again on the biggest stage in college baseball, they come out on top, whether it be excellent pitching against TCU, timely hitting, great defensive plays. They are getting an all-around effort from not only its nine regulars, but again, Michael Robertson is not a regular in this starting lineup. He was inserted as a pinch runner for Tyler Shelnut when he makes that catch. So everyone that gets called upon for the Gators has stepped up, and I think it's another aspect that makes this team so dangerous. And I think to this point, they've relied heavily on the long ball for offensive production. They've hit seven home runs, which is the most in the College World Series field at this point. And I think that it's from an LSU perspective, a little scary or a little frightening that we haven't even seen. And again, Charles Schwab Stadium is whatever the antithesis of a hitter friendly ballpark. Like, it's nearly impossible to put up crazy lopsided offensive numbers. But the fact that Florida really hasn't had that offensive explosion where they're driving the ball around the yard, hitting line drives everywhere, the fact they haven't had that yet, I think, is a little bit worrisome, because it just feels like a ticking time bomb with the personnel they have, obviously, with Curlin, Langford, Caglione, and Rivera up at the top. It feels like they're a little bit due for an outburst.
Yeah, you can take the way that Florida has played here a couple different ways. Like, I think Florida has, like, I don't want to say they've played poorly in Omaha, but they are not playing their best baseball, and yet they've won anyway. So, like, there's a lot to be said for teams being able to win despite not playing their best baseball. And I think in many respects that bodes well for Florida, either because, like you're saying, Peter, that there's better baseball to come. Like, how long can you expect Florida not to play its best baseball? This is one of the best teams in the country and has been all season. But it's also just like, well, okay, like this is a team that knows how to win, knows how to grind things out, even when things aren't at their optimal level. Like this is a team that just is, you know, that they're finding a way. And like there's just a lot to be said for that. You could also look at it if you're LSU and say, well, like, okay, like if they're not going to play any better, like while TCU, Oral Roberts, and Virginia weren't able to take advantage, maybe we will be. And, so I think that makes it interesting here going into that championship series. But the way that Florida has pitched has been quite impressive. Their bullpen has been pitching really well. Hurston Waldrop was really good again here in Omaha, as he has been throughout the NCAA tournament. And if I'm Florida, that's what I'm feeling best about right now. Offensively, they have really struggled. Their batting average right now, which I don't have in front of me, but I can tell you that it's, as a team, Florida is hitting worse in Omaha than UCLA did in 2013 when it won the title. And UCLA hit like 213 or 211 as a team that year, and it was the lowest batting average in the College World Series by a team that won the national title. And there was a lot made of that. That was in the absolute deadest of the dead ball era here in college baseball. And obviously Florida's making up for it because they're just getting big hits and they're hitting home runs and like their slugging percentage is great, but like there's way more to this than batting average. However, like they're not getting runners on very often, and that is a little disconcerting. But they, again, to their credit, they just keep finding a way to win, and they have the dudes in the lineup that can hit home runs, like top to bottom, basically. Pretty much everyone that they're going to run out to the plate is a home run threat. And what we've seen so far is that Florida is very opportunistic in that, and that their pitching staff is good enough to make one or two run home runs stand up.
Yeah, and I think that you made a great point, because there are always two sides to it. And if I'm LSU, it's like, okay, they're relying on the long ball in the stadium that I'd say you're least wise to rely on the long ball in, with Charles Schwab. Like that kind of, I wouldn't say mentality, but winning games like that where you're living and dying with a home run, with the home run ball at Charles Schwab Stadium, is a very dangerous line to toe. And then also, if I'm LSU, I'm thinking, okay, we have this tidal wave of momentum right now. And I think that, I think with the off days, with Florida having 2 days of rest, I think it's a good thing, and it also could be a bad thing. With LSU, they've only got the one off day. They can kind of stay in that keep rolling mentality where it's like they don't really have much time to like sit and be stagnant. Not saying that Florida is, but I think that there is a little bit of an upside to kind of staying in your rhythm and keeping your momentum rolling for LSU. And I think that their lineup has showed more prowess than Florida to this point. But also with the Gators, you're going to have your starting pitching lined up with Sproat and Waldrop, Jack Caglione if necessary. Your bullpen is going to be fresh and rested. And then kind of the key, as it's been all year for Waldrop and Sproat, and Caglione for that matter, is consistency. You see them turn in excellent outings, and then their following one, they'll come back a little bit sporadic, spray the ball a little bit. But I think that for Waldrop, he's finally found that consistency. In his last 21 innings, he's allowed just 2 earned runs, and he's struck out 37 hitters, I think it is. So it looks like he has really, really hit his stride, made himself a lot of money recently. And I think that he's a guy that you're going to be really, really comfortable giving the ball to on the mound to either clinch a national championship or in game one. I think it'll be for the national championship if
they're not going to deviate. It'll be Sproat and then Waldrop.
Yeah, so in a potential national championship clinching game, or in a or to bring the Gators even, I think that he's a guy that you can have a lot of confidence giving the ball to. And then with Sproat, the key all year has been throwing strikes. I mean, he doesn't really get barreled up all that often. It's just sprayed command has kind of been his bugaboo and done him in. He's got as loud a stuff as anyone in the country, and for my money's worth, with his exploding fastball. And then the plus split change and his slider. So there are so many different ways, like each team, there are so many pros and cons for each club right now coming into this championship series. So it's just going to be fascinating to watch it unfold. And I know that we'll probably talk about it more in a little bit. Just the one thing I'm really, I guess, interested, concerned, intrigued by, a whole litany of adjectives, is LSU's pitching. Because again, you get to this point, which is outstanding. But you are, I mean, Paul Skeens is such a nut job in the best way possible. So I don't want to say like Florida's not going to see him for an inning. If that, if that scenario arises,
if they play on Monday, I feel like I'm not saying he starts the game, but I think there's a very realistic chance he pitches.
Right. Like if it goes to three, then Florida might see Skeens to close it out. But again, for the most part, they're not going to see Skeens. Thatcher Hurd has also been used a lot recently. It's, again, you're going to need, you're probably going to need Ty Floyd to step up on short rest. And then, again, just as Nate Ackenhausen and Griffin Herring have done, same with Thatcher Hurd, someone to step up. And is that guy Christian Little that we're talking? It's just, They're going to need to have guys continue to step up and rise to the occasion.
So you talked about the off days or the fact that Florida gets this off day and how that could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing for them. And, this is small sample size and every year is different and the format even has changed since what the stat that I'm about to say began. But the last five times that, so in Omaha, there are the two different brackets. And if you're the last five times that only one bracket has gone to the if necessary game, the team that had to play the if necessary game, not the team with the extra S, the team that had to play the if necessary game has gone on to win the national title. That includes Ole Miss last year in this new format, beating Oklahoma, but that goes all the way back to 2012 was the last time that didn't happen, that Arizona got the extra day of rest, South Carolina didn't, and Arizona won the national title all the way back in 2012. Every time since then, if there's been only one bracket that plays the if necessary game, the team that had to play the extra game wins the national title. So there was a lot of discourse yesterday as the game begins and, that you see both teams pitching their aces and then it continues and you see bullpens and getting taxed and all the rest of that, that this is great for Florida. And it's not bad for Florida, but there is also something to, the momentum or staying in it or whatever. It's a small sample, but it's also not a sample. I'm not just saying Ole Miss did this last year. And then if you go and you look, it's the last seven times it happened, the team with the extra rest won. I don't know what it is, because it's not necessarily even always momentum, because a year ago, it wasn't like Ole Miss came out of the loser's bracket. They did it. They went 2-0 and then lost a game and then had to play on Thursday. So I don't know what it is. I don't really know what to make of it other than this time of year, things are not as simple as they have their rest or they have their pitching lined up. There's just so much that goes into winning these games that these easy narratives, and I'm not hating anyone that's grasping at them. I certainly do that as well. But these easy narratives just don't play the same way in Omaha as you might expect them to.
Yeah, and for lack of better phrasing, it's going to get weird. You're going to see guys thrust into scenarios that you're not used to seeing them. Really on the pitching side, it's just going to kind of be, you'll have your starters for each game, and then from there on, it's kind of wherever the game is headed is going to dictate who you use in any given scenario. So I know that with the Gators, I think that everyone for the most part is on close, if not completely full rest, which I think plays in their favor. And then with LSU, again, it's just, you're going to have to find that next guy who you feel confident in giving you a really strong 3-4, maybe 5 innings. I think Blake Money is someone that stands out to me as a guy that will be relied upon for that, potentially Christian Little as well. And then even Javon Coleman, who started in that first game against Wake Forest and was not sharp, but the Tigers did come back and win to force that game 3. So he only threw 40 pitches. I think that you can kind of circle back on him. And then in talking about short rest, Ty Floyd could be another guy that.
So my guess is Ty Floyd starts game 1 and they'll ride whatever they can out of him. You're going to see a lot of Riley Cooper. Like, I guarantee that. I assume they'll go back to Ackenhausen for game 2. But by game 2, Thatcher Hurd should be fully ready to go as well, I would say. You know, like, the thing is, the circle gets smaller in Omaha. It doesn't get bigger. And, like, so to an extent, I guess it has gone bigger for LSU, but, you know, it's going to be the guys that you've seen to this point, by and large. Because with the title on the line, like, you want your dudes out there. Now, having said that, like, weird things happened. 2017, when these two teams played, like, they both had to go through the if necessary game, and they both played, you know, so they both played that extra game, and they had to, in game 2, both start dudes that they were not expecting to start. That was the Tyler Dyson game for Florida, and that was, oh man, I don't even remember who started for LSU, but it was not a pitcher they had intended to use in that kind of situation. So weird things do happen, and somebody is going to have to step up, but I also think that, like, it's the guys that we're dancing with the guys who brought us here at this point, you know, for both of these teams. And, you know, Riley Cooper has already pitched like 3 times in Omaha, I think. He's going to pitch a couple more times, I would guess. And for Florida, like, Brandon Neely has closed every one of these games, and you're going to see a lot of Brandon Neely again over the next couple days. Like, this is tiredness doesn't really exist in Omaha, I guess, is the best way to put it. Like, this is what everyone has played all season to do. And these pitchers are going to go out there and lay it all on the line if they can.
Yeah, no, and I think that you summed it up perfectly, that, like, tiredness does not exist. It's all adrenaline. There is not going to be a single arm that doesn't want the baseball. And I think that, as you said, heavy doses of Riley Cooper can be expected. And he's been great out here. Nate Ackenhausen, again, was excellent in his start, season-long 7 innings pitched. They've, again, as you said, you dance with the guys that got you here. So I know that the Tigers are going to have the utmost confidence in their dudes, and same with Florida.
All right, well, let's get a quick break in here. We're going to come back, and we're going to make some picks for this championship series. And, you know, we're going to also talk a little bit about some of these teams that have been eliminated, because I don't want to gloss over what Wake Forest season was, what Oral Roberts did to get here, and, you know, Tennessee and Stanford and you know, Virginia. I think I mentioned them all now. Like, those teams were really impressive here, and so I want to touch on them as well. But first, check this out.
If you know me, you know how much I hate making plans. But something I hate even more is having nothing to do. So enter Game Time. Game Time has made it so easy to look up events happening tonight in my area, and I can buy tickets the easy way. So maybe I'll head to a Nationals game, or I'll go see a concert or a comedy show, whatever. I get access to the best seats and the best deals at the last minute, all while keeping my plans stress-free, just how I like them. I mean, it's the fastest growing ticketing app in the country for a reason. Buy tickets in a matter of seconds, 2 taps and you're set. Tickets are sent directly to your phone, so you never have to dig through all of those unread emails. Snag the tickets without the stress with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code BASEBALLAMERICA for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code BASEBALLAMERICA for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets, lowest price, guaranteed.
All right, Peter. So we've dived into the finals breakdown a little bit here. In terms of the pitching, we mentioned that Florida has not had its best offensive performance out here. LSU, I don't know. Where do you think their lineup is right now? Like, we just saw Wake Forest shut them down for 10 innings, but, you know, Wake Forest is a really good pitching staff. Where do you feel like LSU is offensively as we go into the finals?
So it's tough because, as you mentioned, Wake Forest, I think for my money's worth, has the best pitching staff out here. Even though they're eliminated, I think that it's tough to argue with that. And so in LSU's five games, they've seen Wake three times and Tennessee twice. So it's two really good, obviously really good teams. And then they've also seen really good pitchers, as they saw Andrew Lindsay with Tennessee in their first game with the Vols. And then in the second game with the Vols, they had Drew Beam. So it's not like LSU has had like a bunch of guys to be able to jump on and potentially take advantage of. And I thought that while they've been a little bit quieter than I had thought, they have gotten production from guys like Cade Belozo with the huge three-run home run against Wake Forest. And then obviously Tommy White last night, and Dylan Cruz has been Dylan Cruz. So I think a little bit quieter than I had expected, but I also came in with my expectations a little bit in check, both given the format of their bracket and then also just how the ball plays in Charles Schwab Stadium, how impossible it is to get it out and get it in the gaps and in these vast outfields. So I'd say a little bit underwhelmed, but also understanding of who they've had to face.
There was some talk about Tommy White struggling in Omaha. And like he hasn't lit the world on fire out here, but I think that is too much. Like, I would not go that far, you know, prior to the home run, he and Dylan Cruz, Dylan Cruz had the single to get the rally to get the 11th inning started yesterday. Neither one of them has, again, expectations on those two are so high that, you know, if they make outs, it's people think it's all of a sudden they're struggling. But, you know, Trey Morgan has actually been LSU's best player out here. Like, I would guess that if we voted right now LSU most outstanding player, that it would be Paul Skeens, and that's probably deserving. But like, Trey Morgan has been LSU's best position player to this point in the World Series. If he can stay hot, and, you know, Cruz and White keep getting on base ahead of him, like that starts to be a little more exciting from an LSU standpoint. But both of these lineups are, they're not pitchable, like that's the wrong word for it, but there are not, it's not 1 through 9, like no breaks in the lineup right now. Like, there are some guys in there that are pressing or not pressing, whatever, but like it's not, in this ballpark at least, it's not neither of these are just like, oh wow, you cannot pitch to these lineups. Now we say like, oh, in this ballpark, and like it's playing pitcher friendly and everything, but if the wind flips, things change. And I honestly think at this point that if the wind were to flip and it were to play, the wind were to start blowing out, or at least stop blowing in at like the rate at which it has been, that's probably advantage LSU, because it will neutralize some of Florida's advantage on the mound. I know that like I try not to look at early forecasts, especially for wind, but I have heard that Sunday afternoon is projected to be a little bit different. And that I do think that'd be bad news for Florida. Like, you have the advantage on the mound, especially on Sunday. I would want it to be as good as it could be for me in terms of a pitching environment. But we'll have to see what the weather has in store for us. Defensively, I feel like both of these teams are playing really well. I mean, they've both made some outstanding plays. Josh Rivera has looked fantastic. You know, I said Trey Morgan was LSU's best position player here. I mean, for me, Josh Rivera has been Florida's best position player here. And the way that he's playing shortstop is has really been a huge plus for the Gators.
Yeah, and the best way to sum it up, it's just been pro-like. I mean, he's very comfortable moving to either side. He's made a lot of big time plays and big time situations look very, very easy and low maintenance. He certainly looks the part of someone who's going to be selected on day one of the draft. How high it is, I guess we'll find out soon enough. But, and then as far as swinging the bat goes, he's, I think, probably been their best bat too. Two home runs. He's 4 for 12. Only struck out twice. He's, I mean, he's kind of been the straw that stirs the drink for the Gators out here. And for LSU, I think that goes to Trey Morgan. After last night, it's going to be tough to argue against Tommy White for a number of reasons. And then Dylan Cruz has done his Dylan Cruz thing with a few multi-hit games, his backside home run. But Trey Morgan, I think, might be getting a little bit overlooked. Defensively, he has been really just out of this world, whether it be really good picks, great stretches. Last night's play on the safety squeeze where he actually started on the dirt because he had to hold the runner on first, because it was a first and third scenario. He had to hold the runner on first. Merrick Houston doesn't square around until he's not showing, or he is showing, but then Trey Morgan has to then crash, make a great flip to Alex Milazzo, and they nab Justin Johnson at the plate. So Morgan has been excellent. And then with the wind, it's such an interesting dynamic because, again, you talk about how anti-hitter this park is, but every single day that we've been there, the flags are blowing straight at us in behind home plate where we're seated in the press box. So if that were to flip, I think that it heavily favors an LSU team who they really get the ball in the air often. They have a ton of guys with firepower. Obviously Florida does too, but I think that with how this has gone, LSU would have a lot of home runs to their name. If the win was flipped, who knows if it will be. And then, as you mentioned, each of these lineups are, it's really, really good, but I think that you can feel more comfortable both, being in attack mode on the mound and kind of, especially when the wind is blowing in and not being scared of being beat by a home run. And especially with the bottom third of the order, I think for LSU in particular, I know that the top third has been dynamite with Cruz, White, Morgan, even Braden Joubert has had a good, couple of good games, but I think that you can feel rather comfortable going after those 6 through 9 hitters right now. And obviously that could change on a dime as they're immensely talented. But I think if you're Florida, you can feel pretty good about attacking those guys in the lineup.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch all of that evolve here in Omaha. This is also a case where both, I talked a lot about experience throughout the course of the season, when especially in regards to Wake Forest and like would it eventually cost them, and I don't know that it did. Like you can second guess various moves that were made throughout the tournament for Wake and whatever. I mean, you can do that to any of these teams. I was doing it in real time last night, wondering why Wake wasn't going to its closer. Then as soon as Wake does go to its closer, Tommy White calls game. So, whatever. Things happen. And decisions are made and they work or they don't work. I don't know if the experience cost Wake in the end. I think it was probably more just they ran up against a really good team and maybe Wake didn't know what to do with the pressure that it was experiencing for the first time, in the same way that Tennessee and Arkansas and UCLA were all felled by that in the last few years and go on back as far as 20 plus years for all the number one seeds that have lost. But having said all of that, both of these coaches have, Kevin O'Sullivan and Jay Johnson, have both coached in College World Series finals before. Sully has a national title. Jay Johnson does not, but they both have that CWS finals experience. They know what's going to be happening this weekend. They know the, coaching with these stakes. I mean, it is I think these are two of the better staffs in terms of, pitch calling and managing their players and everything. So I from that chess match perspective, I'm going to call this one a push. But I do think it's notable that both of these guys, have been on this stage before.
Yeah, and similar to describing Josh Rivera's play as shortstop, each of these staffs, I mean, it's pro-like. It's as good as you're going to get in college baseball, both at the head coaching level and then also below them with their assistants. And then you talk about the pitch calling and the moves that they make in-game and kind of managing on the fly. It's going to be a real chess match for a few days. That it's going to be a fun game to watch beyond the game.
Yes, absolutely. So, having broken this down from just about every, at least all of the ways that I can think of, pitching, defense, offense, and what's going on in the dugout, Peter, I think it's time for us to make picks. So, who do you got?
Oh, man. See, I thought about it falling asleep last night. I thought about it on my walk back to the lovely courtyard in which I'm staying. I'm going to say LSU in three games.
Wow. Okay. I thought you were going to go the other way. I am going to continue to ride with LSU. I've done it since the preseason, not jumping off now. I will also say in three games because I think that if LSU is to win this, it really needs to win it in three. I think, game one is winnable. LSU beat Brandon Sproat a year ago. These teams didn't play this year, but they beat Sproat a year ago. Sproat's a better pitcher now and everything, but they know what they're looking at in terms of Sproat, and they've had success against him before. He has been good in the NCAA tournament, but like he's given consistent quality starts. I think this last one was he didn't quite go six, but that's been pretty consistently what he's doing. But he's also not throwing six scoreless, so I think they've got a reasonable shot to win game one. Hurston Waldrop is a real problem in game two, and LSU has faced him a year ago when he was at Southern Miss, I believe. And I feel good about Florida with Waldrop on the mound. And then in game three, if it gets there, anything can happen. And I'm gonna go with LSU on this one.
Yeah, I like it. And you make a great point because LSU for, and again, Sproat's a better pitcher than he was a year ago, but more or less, they know what they're going to see with him. And then with Waldrop on Saturday, I don't want to call game one a must win because anything really can happen, but I think that they would really, really, for a number of reasons, like to have game one under the belt. So I have faith they're going to do that. Sunday, I do think that Florida is going to win. And then on Monday, I think LSU wins 6-5 to 3, and Paul Skeens gets the last three outs.
Now it's very interesting that I'm just going to gloss over the Paul Skeens thing. Like that's clearly the most important thing that you said, but we're moving on. So I'm currently looking. Yes, last year they did face Waldrop, and they won the game that Waldrop started in regionals. But Waldrop goes 6 2/3, struck out 11. Held them to two runs. So, both teams are better. Both LSU is better than they were a year ago, and Waldrop's better than he was a year ago. But they have interestingly seen both of those two pitchers before. Again, they did not play this year, but LSU still has faced both of Florida's top two starters. So we both picked LSU. We are probably going to be in the minority, Peter. Like I haven't seen like official betting lines, but I'm sure that Florida's the favorite in those markets. I have been texting SEC coaches this morning for a piece that you'll find on baseballamerica.com, probably by the time this podcast is posted. And so far I have one, two, three, four. Four, five, six. This is great audio. Yeah, I think six coaches have responded to me so far. We're talking head coaches. It's 5-1 Florida in terms of predictions. So yeah, like we're going to be in the minority here. I think a lot of people are looking at the way Florida has set up their has their pitching rotation set up. I know that there is just an incredible amount of talent on the Florida roster. So they deserve to be favorites, I think. But it's I we'll see. But you and I do anticipate being in the minority here.
Yeah, I think so too. But similar to you, LSU was also my preseason national champion, and I'm not gonna, you know what, I'm gonna ride with them for a couple more games.
Yeah, at this point, hopping out Florida is not going to get you anything. So, if everyone
Exactly.
else is going to say Florida, like you might as well like say LSU and hope that you can point to what we said in January and February as being a very insightful prediction when at the time we were just picking the best team.
Exactly.
All right, so that's the finals matchup. Let's circle back to some of these teams that are no longer playing. Wake Forest, what an incredible year for the Deeks. They fall one win shy of playing for the national title, but you know, 54 wins on the year, win the ACC, get back to Omaha for the first time since 1955, like have this like all-time pitching staff. You know, Josh Hartle and Rhett Lauder were trading the single season strikeout record back and forth there for a minute. Lauder ends up with it. Sorry to Mike Buddy, Army athletic director, who's actually in Omaha because he's a part of the selection committee. So he's doing his committee duties here, but he's a Wake Forest alum who up until very recently was their strikeout holder. But the season the Deeks had, I mean, you can't say enough about it at this point, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that outside of 1955, I think there's an argument to be made that this was the best season in school history. They won the most overall games with 54. The talent, as you alluded to, on both sides of the baseball was exceptional, with multiple 2023 and 2024 first-round picks. Obviously, Wilkin and Lauder for this year, and then looking towards next year, Nick Kurtz, and then potentially even Michael Massey on day one. So, really,
don't forget Hartle.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and Josh Hartle. So it obviously ended short of its eventual goal for Wake with its heartbreaking loss last night, but they've got a strong core to build around, assuming everyone's back. It's going to be a very offensive club, I think, again, and I don't think it'll be as slam dunk a pick as it was before this season to say that they're going to make it back to Omaha. But at this point now, you're talking about a coaching staff and a core group of guys that know what it takes to get to that point, which I think will be very valuable going forward, not only next year, but so long as Coach Walter is in Winston-Salem. So I think they're, again, set up for a period of some sustained success and just an unbelievable season for the ages for the Deeks.
Yeah, as long as they hold this together, and you know, there's no reason to believe that they won't, I would say, but just in today's environment, obviously things could change quickly, but as long as they hold this together, I mean, it looks pretty good for next year as well. You know, you've got a legit one and Hartle, and you know, you're losing Wilkin, but you still have Kurtz. And you know, if there's one thing Wake Forest has done really well under you know, historically, like the pitching has been great in recent years, but like if you go further back, even like Wake Forest has done a really good job at finding hitters, and you think about what Will Craig did several years ago, and you know, they often have lineup anchors like that, and that's what Nick Kurtz is, and they'll be able to build around that guy, and you can build around Hartle on the mound. You know, Michael Massey probably moves into the rotation, I would guess, and that's a strong 1-2 punch. And coming into this year, one of my biggest concerns about Wake Forest was just that like they'd had some moments, but they'd never been able to put everything together really. And now they have. So I don't have to worry about that. They've been here. They've won an ACC title. I don't have to sit here and say like, do they know what it takes to they have what it takes to, you know, to put it all together for sustain that success over the entire course of the season. Like they've done it. They know what it looks like. They've got players that know what it looks like. So I anticipate Wake Forest being pretty good again next year. And we'll see if that's enough to get here again. But they've got some really nice pieces to build around as they try and make a return to Omaha. I do not think, here's a hot take, I don't think it'll be 70 years until they make it back here again.
I agree.
I don't think we're seeing one of those droughts out of Wake Forest again. So whether it's next year or sometime in the future, I think we'll see them back here. TCU makes a bracket final. They won the Big 12 title, tournament title. It was a weird season, I would say, for TCU, up and down the first couple months, but they found themselves in May and went on a run. And, you know, this was a team that coming into the year, we ranked in the top 15, like we thought they were going to be good. It took them a little while to get there, but I mean, the freshmen that were playing here in Omaha for TCU, Anthony Silva, shortstop, Cole Klecker, making a couple starts at the front of their rotation, you know, Bowen, like they had some really nice underclassmen, and to have them blossom the way they did at the end of the season, I think that's huge for the Horned Frogs.
Yeah, and I think that obviously for any of the eight teams in Omaha, I think once they, other than the one that ends up on top, whether that's LSU or Florida, I think that they're all going to leave with a little bit of a sour taste in their mouth and with that chip on its shoulder. But once they can marinate on it, I think that obviously each season was wildly successful just to get here. And especially for TCU, who I think is ahead of schedule in terms of, like, I guess the success that they're going to have. They came into the tournament as, I'd say, arguably the hottest team in the country. They just ripped off four straight to win the Big 12. And then they swept through Fayetteville before sweeping Indiana State. And then they were, they were right on the cusp of a championship series. If they had somehow beaten Florida on Wednesday, they would have been playing for a spot in the championship series, but didn't happen. They do have an outstanding young core that they're going to be able to build around. They are going to lose some talent with, most notably Braden Taylor, and then Trey Richardson is also going to be gone, and then potentially Cole Fontenelle. But offensively, you're going to have Carson Bowen back, who hit 350 with 15 doubles and 6 home runs. Is a great catcher. Calls a great game, really knows how to handle a pitching staff. You're going to have Anthony Silva, who is a bona fide stud over at shortstop, made one of the defensive plays of the tournament. It was in the third or the fourth inning of the very first game here.
Yeah, it was right out of the chute. I think it might have even been the second inning. We had just started playing, and it was like, oh, hello.
Yeah, it was right away. He went up the middle, made a slide, and then in one fell swoop, one fell motion, popped up, fired a strike over to first base, and everyone was like, whoa, holy cow, this kid is legit. And then I think on the pitching side of things, they have an even better core to build around, if you can even comprehend that, with Cole Klecker leading the way in the rotation, who was excellent all year, pitchability guy, is clearly unfazed by the bright lights of Omaha. And I think getting this experience, making a couple starts here, and a couple of good starts at that, is going to be extremely valuable for him going forward. And then guys like Cohen Feaser and Ben Abelt, who I think has a chance to be one of the most dominant relievers in all of college baseball next year. And then Luis Rodriguez, again, a freshman who performed well for the Horned Frogs, but hadn't thrown since May 18th, I think, due to an injury. But again, I think that they're, ahead of schedule with what they're doing. And I think that, again, TCU, similar to Wake, TCU is going to have Omaha buzz just like Wake will going into next year. But I think the Horned Frogs have a real chance to make another run and a potentially deeper run at it next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that TCU probably goes into next year as the Big 12 favorite. I'm not as far along in my 2024 prep as I usually would be this time of year. And I know Texas should be pretty good as well in its final Big 12 season. But all those underclassmen coming back for TCU, you gotta feel really good about their ability to compete at the top of the conference once again. Quick update. I have a seventh SEC coach weighing in.
5-2?
It is 6-1.
Oh, man. Jeez. Stop the count.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, there are 14 SEC teams. Two of them are playing. I didn't text those two guys. So, we have reached Florida is going to be going to win this vote. Oral Roberts, the Golden Eagles you said that outside of 55, this is the best season in Wake Forest history. Like, absolutely. This was the best season in Oral Roberts history. They had made it here in 78. I'm willing to say that everyone there would probably say that this year was even better than that. They win 50 plus games. They had a 21 game winning streak. They also had a dude who had a 47 game hitting streak. But it was, they go 23-1 in Summit League play. They're the third number four seed in the super regional history to super regional era to advance this far. And then they played well while they were here. they did not get blown out. Stony Brook got blown out a couple times when they got here as a four seed. Oral Roberts not only won a game, but they did win a game, but the losses were close losses when they took them. They really acquitted themselves well on this stage.
Yeah, they more than showed that, you know, again, they're going to be talked about as a, again, I'm using air quotes, as a Cinderella team, just given the fact that they were a four seed. But make no mistake about it, this was a team that absolutely rolled, as you said, through the Summit League, 23-1, conference record, back-to-back conference champs. And then in that Stillwater Regional, like, I mean, they obviously they're the best team coming out of it because they won it and swept through it, but they looked, you know, on from a sheer talent perspective too, like the best team there. And the same thing in Eugene against Oregon. And coming into Omaha, they won the opening game against TCU, played a potential national champion. They, at the very least, a finalist. They played them to a one-run game. And then at the end, I think they just ran out of gas against TCU. But it's just a really gritty group of veteran, older guys. They love playing for each other. They love playing for their school. Outside of Cade Denton and I guess Jonah Cox, maybe even throw Jacob Widener in there, it's not a super prospecty bunch. Denton, I think, is a top 5 to 8 round pick, but stopper of the year, Summit League pitcher of the year. He was lethal, and he showed off what makes him so great in Omaha too. He had a couple of strong outings. His first outing against TCU wasn't overly sharp. It was some uncharacteristic command issues, but in the Golden Eagles loss, the season-ending loss to TCU, fired 4 shutout innings with 6 strikeouts. So a really nice note for Denton to go out on. Showed off his signature sinker-slider combo. That's just devastating for opposing hitters. And then Jonah Cox, one of the best hitters in the country, maybe the best hitter in the country that doesn't get talked about, I think, is enough as he should. I think his hitting streak ended up being 48 games.
47.
47 games, regardless, super impressive, recorded a hit in 64 or 63 of his 65 games played. Showed out here in Omaha with a 3-hit game against TCU. Again, a nice note for Cox to go out on. But for the Golden Eagles, best year in school history. I know that they're going to lose a lot to graduation and the draft, but given what they're building there, I don't know, you can't really project a team like this to make it back to Omaha, but I can almost for certain say that if they win the Summit League again and get into the tournament, you are going to be on absolute high alert if the Golden Eagles are in your regional.
Yeah, I thought Jake McMurray said it pretty well in their final press conference here, that like, people in the region knew who Oral Roberts was. And I think people in the know in college baseball, like if you listen to this podcast, you probably were aware of Oral Roberts and like what they historically have been. But they took that to a new audience with what they were able to do here. And everyone, I think, has a little better appreciation of what Oral Roberts can do on the diamond and what they have been for a couple decades now. There was a discourse, as there often is, about whether this was a true Cinderella story or not. And like, look, here's the thing. I don't care whether it was or wasn't. They were underdogs. They played really well throughout the tournament. Like, whether they should have been a 4 or a 3, whatever. But like, no matter how you slice it, they shouldn't have been here. Like, that's not what anybody thought coming into this thing. That they were going to make it through that gauntlet. And even if you say like, oh, well, they had the talent to, like, yeah, okay, they did. Clearly they did. But like, when you put up like that, they had to beat Oklahoma State, Dallas Baptist, Washington, and Oregon to get here, and that all of those games would have been played away from home. I mean, like, that's you're not supposed to be able to do that. Like, no team really is supposed to be able to do that if that's the path that they have to take to get here. No team had a harder path than Oral Roberts to this point. And they, again, they played really, really well over the last month, but actually over the entire course of the season.
Yeah. And not only that, they went 5-1 in those 6 games. Not like they could have afforded to really lose that many more, but like, they cruised through that Stillwater Regional, as you mentioned, against 3, I think, really good team. So the furthest thing from a fluke.
I have an eighth text, and
oh no,
this one doesn't actually have an answer. It has a sarcastic answer, but I believe it's a vote for LSU.
Hey, there we go.
It's not a clear answer, but I believe that's an LSU vote. So we'll take it as 6-2.
I'll take it.
So who else do we got here? We got Virginia, and we got Stanford and Tennessee left. You know, we've talked an awful lot about what Stanford did this year, what Quinn Matthews did to get Stanford here. You know, and there's going to be there is something of a conversation about like, okay, they're really good at getting here. Like, now when are they going to have success in Omaha? But like, to me, like, that kind of undervalues what it takes to get here. It's kind of like a separate conversation about like, when is Stanford going to win in Omaha again? I don't want to like just gloss over the fact that they have turned this into an annual trip, that they've been here three straight times, that they're the class of the Pac-12. And, you know, they've run into some difficult matchups in Omaha, and they have not come away with wins, but you know, they look really good. If you start looking ahead to next year, they still look really good. Like, I still would pick them to win the pack probably, and they'll have to find some new answers. Quinn Matthews is gone, in all likelihood. This, I mean, I would have said the same thing a year ago, but Quinn Matthews is probably gone, and you know, Tommy Troy is gone out of the lineup, but like, they'll have Malcolm Moore back, and like, they have really good players there, and they know what they're doing as a program.
Yeah, and I think you made a great point with, because of Stanford's lack of success in Omaha, people are going to undervalue what they've done. But I think that what's lost is how hard it is just to get to this point, not only just on any single season, but the fact that they've done it three times in a row and basically turned this into like how an eighth grade class goes to Washington, D.C. They go to Omaha. It's like their annual end of school trip. And they got a really, really tough draw this year with bracket two, with, they faced Wake in Tennessee. And they also had LSU in there, and they honestly, they probably should have won both games. They went up against Wake. They went up 2-1, held that lead until the bottom of the eighth. And then against Tennessee, I think that's a game that they really should have won. They went up 4-0, and then things kind of unraveled in the fifth. So, I mean, they were a lot closer than people will realize to being in a really good spot to potentially play for a national championship. And then looking to next year, they do, I mean, they lose a lot offensively. Tommy Troy is going to be gone. Alberto Rios is going to be gone. Eddie Park is gone. Owen Cobb is gone. Carter Graham is gone. Drew Bowser is gone. So it's like, you're going to really have to build around Braden Montgomery and Malcolm Moore, who I think are, I mean, those are two studs to build around. Like, they're losing a lot, but from a personnel standpoint, those are two of the best. Moore, sophomore, will be one of the best sophomores, and then Montgomery will be one of the best juniors in the country. So you could have worse guys to build around. Timo Becerra is another returner who, I know he only got around 60 at-bats, but I think in what he showed both at shortstop and then at the plate, he's someone that is ready to be an everyday contributor. And then on the mound, you lose the workhorse that is Quinn Matthews, and you lose Joey Dixon. But other than that, I think you have some key rotation pieces to build around. Some younger arms showed some flashes, namely Nick Dugan. I know that the back of the baseball card, again, is not going to look great, but towards the end of the year, he really came on. And I think that with Coach Esker, you talk about finding a way, that's all that Stanford does in terms of getting to Omaha, winning the Pac-12, and finding ways to win in the postseason. So until they prove otherwise, it's going to be hard to pick against the Cardinal in getting back to the College World Series.
Absolutely. You know, when you lay it out like that, it starts to look pretty exciting, you know, again. So we will, we'll probably be seeing Stanford here on this stage sooner than later. Possibly as soon as next year. Virginia, the Hoos were, I think they were kind of a little bit of a popular choice for people that were trying to find a reason not to pick Florida to come out of that bracket. Obviously, I went with TCU, but like there was an argument for Virginia, belief that maybe their offense would play really well in this ballpark. And instead, UVA goes two and out. you know, they were in position to win against Florida in game one. And I don't want to say that there was a hangover into game two, but there might have been. Jake Geloff, Kyle Teal, their fantastic careers are going to be over. Teal's going to be a top 10 pick. Geloff will go somewhere in the top 50. And those are two of the best hitters in UVA history. The Hoos are going to have to retool on the mound again. But having watched them do it a year ago and everyone looking around and saying, so who's actually going to pitch for Virginia? And then their pitching staff ranking like fourth in the country in ERA. Like, I'm going to trust that they'll figure that bit of it out. Like, I don't know if this is a missed opportunity for UVA, if that's too strong or what, but like, I do think that UVA will look back fondly at this season because of what Teal and Geloff meant to the program particularly, but also because of the way that they that their pitching staff was able to come together after a lot of uncertainty in the fall and coming into the season.
Yeah, and again, I agree with you, and I think that they will look back on this season very fondly. It was an extremely successful season. It culminated in a trip to the College World Series. You win 50 games for the first time since 2014, I believe. And then even though they're going to lose two of the best hitters in college baseball and in Kyle Teal and Jake Geloff, and then also probably Ethan O'Donnell, I'm pretty bullish on UVA going into next year. Offensively, it's going to, like, you still have Griff O'Farrell back, Ethan Anderson, Anthony Stephon, Casey Saki, Luke Hansen. That's a really good core group of five guys that you can already count on. And then inevitably there'll be a freshman that steps up and then a sophomore that makes a jump. So I think you're in a pretty good spot offensively. Teal and Geloff, their production is borderline irreplaceable with a combined 159 RBIs, but it'll be a little bit of a step back. But again, they have great personnel. And then pitching wise, I think that, you know, you lose probably your whole rotation with Early to the draft and then Edgington and Parker moving on, graduating and then potentially being drafted and signed. Jack O'Connor is a guy that I think is going to slide. He started the season in a Sunday role. He could either stick there or he could pitch on Fridays or Saturdays. And, you know, you'll still be able to have Jay Woolfolk out of the bullpen to close games. And then I think that you can count on any of these freshman arms to potentially slide into a weekend role or a far more prominent role, whether it be Evan Blanco, Bradley Hodges, or Colin McKay. I think that those are a trio of guys that you're going to be really excited about. Same with Kevin Jaxel. I left him out initially, but any of that quartet, I think that you can feel really good about. And then in today's day and age with the transfer portal, UVA is a rather easy sell to guys in the portal, both given the success of the program and then also its high academics. It sets you up very well for your career post baseball. So I again think that the Cavaliers, similar to a lot of these teams that we've talked about, are well positioned to return back here.
All right, last one is the Vols. They are one of the more confusing teams to talk about, I think, because they were the number two team in the preseason top 25. Tony Vitello has been pretty consistent since those polls started getting released that he thought that was an overrank of Tennessee coming into the year. But they end the season, like, spoiler alert, they're going to be like fifth in the top 25. The final poll. They end the season in Omaha. The road here was not the road that I think anybody thought it was going to be. It ends up looking pretty good for the Vols. I think in some ways that probably has to be a pretty satisfying season for their fans, that they were able to overcome some of those early season struggles and find a way forward. It wasn't a runaway success of a year. And ultimately, like, they go 1-4 over the course of the season against LSU. And I think that probably has to hurt, because you know that if you just, like, get a different matchup in Omaha, or if you find a way to win a couple games in Baton Rouge, like, maybe the season looks differently. Maybe you get a home regional and then, you know, who knows how everything plays out. But for them to go on the road throughout the postseason, you know, win at Clemson, win at Southern Miss, get to Omaha, have this incredible pitching staff again, like, and make it to Omaha for the second time in three seasons and win a game in Omaha for the first time since 2001. I do feel like that's real progress for the program.
Yeah, it was a very roller coastery season for the Vols. I mean, we were sitting here after their midweek loss to Tennessee Tech, like sort of half jokingly talking about them like teetering on the bubble of regionals, and then they go on and sweep Vanderbilt. But after last season's premature exit to Notre Dame, I mean, they came into the season with a huge chip on their shoulder. Still had the target on their back as kind of the bad boys of college baseball. It was a really difficult first half of the year, and then they turned it on, and to their credit, they played the best baseball. They played their best baseball this season at the perfect time, and I think that's a big testament to not only Coach Vitello and his outstanding staff around him, but also to the players that they have. And you mentioned it, but they get a difficult draw in going to Clemson. I think that also on the flip side, Clemson got a difficult draw with having Tennessee in their regional, and Tennessee wins one of the, I think the best game prior to the College World Series in that 6-5, 14 inning thriller. They beat Clemson. And then they take down Tanner Hall and Southern Miss in three games. And, you know, in Omaha, as you mentioned, they're 1-4 on the year against LSU. They get a brutal draw with that bracket too. And, you know, they have a winner under their belt with Stanford, and then in the end, LSU comes out on top with kind of a sound 5-0 win. So difficult end of the year for the Vols, but I think that it's one, again, you're going to look back on and be happy about, given I think it's really hard to not be happy about a trip to the College World Series in general. But I think given that all you went through during the year, the early, I think, suspension or holdout of Mal Yehuna, weathering the storm with all those losses, figuring out your pitching on the fly, Chase Burns, I mean, just absolute dynamite out of the bullpen in the College World Series with that 6 shutout innings against Stanford and 9 strikeouts. But yeah, I think that so long as Coach Vitello is at the helm at Tennessee, he's going to get the most out of his guys. And I think looking towards next year, again, you've got great personnel to build around. I think offensively, I'm honed in on Blake Burke, Christian Moore, and Dylan Dreiling. And then on the mound, you're again looking at a rotation that's going to be anchored by, I think that it's going to be really interesting to see what they do with Chase Burns. I think that they're going to try him again in the rotation. So you're looking at a rotation that's going to be led by Chase Burns, Drew Beam, and probably AJ Russell, who in 30 innings this year had a 0.89 ERA with 47 Ks to 7 walks. So the Vols are going to be, you know, right back in it, right back in the thick of it next year.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at you know, that kind of pitching staff, and as long as Frank Anderson and Tony Vitello are leading that team, like, they're going to have a premium pitching staff. So pretty exciting stuff that they can run out there. And, you know, offensively, I think they'll be able to figure it out. You know, like, they are losing some guys, but I would feel pretty good about Tennessee moving forward as well. And, you know, it's just a matter of how it all comes together for them next year. Alrighty, so that's where we're at in the College World Series. We're down to two teams. By, you know, we'll see whether this thing ends Sunday or Monday, but certainly at least by Monday night, there will be a national champion. And this incredible 2023 college baseball season will have come to a close. We'll be back here sometime next week. I have no idea when. There's a lot in the air to recap how the finals go. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Hit that subscribe button, and then whenever it is that we record next week, it'll just go right there to your phone. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. And make sure you're checking everything out over at baseballamerica.com. There is a lot to read, both about the College World Series and everything else baseball as we roll into July here pretty soon. Like, everything's going to go real crazy draft pro side with the futures game and lead up to the trade deadline. So a great time to check everything out over at baseballamerica.com. For Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next week.